The science is clear. The 1.5 degree limit is only possible if we ultimately stop burning all fossil fuels. Not reduce, not abate, phase out.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that will earn that great honour in the future. We are broadcasting from stolen land. It's land that was never ceded, always was, and always will be First Nations land. We acknowledge that we cannot hope to have any form of climate justice until we get justice for First Nations Australians. And finally, we acknowledge that there is a wealth of ancient wisdom that we can use and we will find is very helpful as we navigate the climate crisis. It's the oldest living culture on the planet, and their focus on nurturing both their land and their communities is exactly what we need going forward.
As a young country and a global crossroads, we have always made progress through partnership. Our founders taught us how to live in harmony with nature and with each other, to embrace diversity. Here, in the UAE, we believe that climate action is an opportunity that offers new promise to people and our planet, and that our long-term sustainability will stem from finding practical and pragmatic solutions that create opportunities for all to prosper. And so, today we invite the world to join us, to help us build bridges, create global consensus, and leave no one behind. Together, let us carve a bold new path, a united path. Let our actions speak louder than our ambitions. Let's turn our targets into tangible reality. Because we, the UAE, believe that where there is a will, there is always a way.
I pray with all my heart that COP28 will be another critical turning point towards genuine transformational action at a time when already, as scientists have been warning for so long, we are seeing alarming tipping points being reached. I've spent a large proportion of my life trying to warn of the existential threats facing us over global warming, over climate change and biodiversity loss. The dangers are no longer distant risks. I have seen across the Commonwealth and beyond countless communities which are unable to withstand repeated shocks, whose lives and livelihoods are laid waste by climate change. Surely, real action is required to stem the growing toll of its most vulnerable victims. Repeated cyclones batter vulnerable island nations like Vanuatu and Dominica. India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan have been experiencing unprecedented floods, and East Africa is suffering a decades-long drought. This past summer, in common with Spain, Greece, the United States, and many other countries, Canada experienced its most severe wildfire season on record, with 18.5 million hectares of land burned, causing terrible loss of life and property, and of course, releasing enormous amounts of greenhouse gases that contribute to dangerous feedback loops to which climate scientists have been alerting us for decades. As I've tried to say on many occasions, unless we rapidly repair and restore nature's unique economy based on harmony and balance, which is our ultimate sustainer, our own economy and survivability will be imperiled. Records are now being broken so often that we are perhaps becoming immune to what they are really telling us. When we see the news that this last Northern Hemisphere summer, for instance, was the warmest global average temperature on record, we need to pause to process what this actually means. We are taking the natural world outside balanced norms and limits and into dangerous, uncharted territory. We are carrying out a vast, frightening experiment of changing every ecological condition all at once, at a pace that far outstrips nature's ability to cope. As we work towards a zero carbon future, we must work equally towards being nature positive. With what we are witnessing, our choice now is a starker and darker one. How dangerous are we actually prepared to make our world? Dealing with this is a job for us all. Change will come by working together and making it easier to embrace decisions that will sustain our world, rather than carry on as though there are no limits or as though our actions have no consequences. As you gather, ladies and gentlemen, for these critical negotiations, the hope of the world rests on the decisions you must take. I can only encourage you to consider some practical questions which might inform the task ahead of you. Firstly, how can our multilateral organizations, which were established at a different time for different challenges, be strengthened for the crisis we face? How can we bring together our public, private, philanthropic, and NGO sectors ever more effectively so that they all play their part in delivering climate action, each complementing the unique strengths of the others? Public finance alone will never be sufficient, but with the private sector firmly at the table and a better, fairer international financial system, combined with the innovative use of risk reduction tools like first loss risk guarantees, we could mobilize the trillions of dollars we need, in the order of 4.5 to 5 trillion a year, to drive the transformation we need. Secondly, how can we ensure that finance flows to those developments most essential to a sustainable future and away from practices that make our world more dangerous, across every industry in every part of the world? I have, for instance, been heartened by some of the steps taken by parts of the insurance sector, which plays such a vital role in incentivizing more sustainable approaches and providing an invaluable source of investment to reduce the risks we face. Thirdly, how can we accelerate innovation and the deployment of renewable energy, of clean technology and other green alternatives to move decisively towards investment in this vital transition across all industries? For instance, how can we increase investments in regenerative agriculture, which can be a nature-positive carbon sink? What incentives are necessary? And how can those which have a perverse impact be eliminated with all due speed? Fourthly, how can we bring together different solutions and initiatives to ensure coherent, long-term approaches across sectors, countries, and industries? For virtually every artificial source of greenhouse gas emissions, there are alternatives or mitigations which can be put in place. That is why it is encouraging to see industry transition plans being developed both nationally and globally, which will help each sector of our global economy onto practical pathways to a zero carbon nature positive future. And, ladies and gentlemen, fifthly, how can we forge an ambitious new vision for the next 100 years? How can we draw on the extraordinary ingenuity of our societies, the ideas, knowledge, and energy of our young people, our artists, our engineers, our communicators, and importantly, our indigenous peoples, to imagine a sustainable future for people everywhere, a future that is in harmony with nature, not set against her? Ladies and gentlemen, in your hands is an unmissable opportunity to keep our common hope alive. I can only urge you to meet it with ambition, imagination, and a true sense of the emergency we face, and together with a commitment to the practical action upon which our shared future depends. After all, ladies and gentlemen, in 2050, our grandchildren won't be asking what we said. They will be living with the consequences of what we did or didn't do. So if we act together to safeguard our precious planet, the welfare of all our people will surely follow. And we need to remember, too, that the indigenous worldview teaches us that we are all connected, not only as human beings, but with all living things and all that sustains life. As part of this grand and sacred system, harmony with nature must be maintained. The earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth.
Thank you, King Charles, who's also the King of Australia, right?
He's King Charles III of Australia.
What we just listened to here was a speech from COP28, the big global climate summit organized by the United Nations. It's an annual event, and I think it's getting more and more tense in a way, with 80,000 people gathering now. When King Charles speaks, the world listens. I have not seen a video copied by as many newspapers as this particular speech. It's out front page news. It's put out as full 10-minute videos from almost every news outlet that exists, you know, CNN, Deutsche Welle, BBC, and so on. So that tells me that the world is listening. And I find it brilliant that we have in King Charles a leader who understands where we're at and what we need to do. He says it so clearly. And I'm just hoping that, you know, Australians, are you listening? Not just the politicians, but also people who listen to the Pulse and the people who come after us. Are you listening to King Charles? Let's hear what else has been happening around the world. Colin Market, OAM, what do you have for us in your weekly bulletin, The Global Outlook?
Good morning, Mick. I couldn't really go past Dubai, where, as you pointed out, more than 80,000 delegates. It was just shy of 90,000 delegates. They're attending right now, or they are expected to attend COP28. Just imagine how much aviation fuel was burned to put those 90,000 people into Dubai. And if past COPs are anything to go by, the largest numbers of people there are fossil fuel industry lobby groups. Such is their influence that the chair of this year's conference is the head of one of the world's largest fossil fuel companies. He's Sultan Al-Jaber, whose day job is chief executive of the United Arab Emirates state-owned oil company. He started the big show with a big surprise announcement that an agreement had been forged to create a new fund to help poor nations cope with costly climate disasters. The announcement was warmly received because wrangling over loss and damage has long been a divisive issue at the annual COP talks. It took up most of COP27 in Egypt because the rich nations who caused the majority of CO2 emissions pushed back against creating a fund that would assist the poorer nations who've done the least to cause climate change. In practice, establishing the fund on the first day of the conference allowed countries 2 weeks to announce how much they'll be giving to the fund. The UAE kicked off this fund with $100 million. And that sounds a lot until you realize that it's around 7 hours of oil production for the Emirates. At the end of day one, the fund had grown considerably, and it's still growing now. $370 million was pledged by the European Union, £20 million came from the US, and £14 million from Japan. Australia is yet to say what it will contribute. Although the shift to clean energy is gathering pace, the United Nations says the world is still only taking baby steps towards its aims, when leaps and strides are urgently needed. That's because this year has been the hottest on record, and greenhouse gas emissions, which are causing that heating, they're continuing to grow. And putting money into a fund is the easy way of solving your conscience, if you like, when what you should be really doing, what we all should be really doing, is reducing the amount of emissions we're putting into the atmosphere. And King Charles wasn't the only person who was speaking at the opening of COP28. The UN's Secretary General was there too. And on the way there, he made a brief Antarctic visit before going to Dubai. And he was typically blunt. Referring to the shrinking ice coverage due to rapid global warming, Antonio said, "We are witnessing an acceleration that is absolutely devastating. The Antarctic is waking up, and the world must wake up too." He said that Sultan Al-Jaber had a bigger responsibility to drive the fossil fuel industry at COP28 to ramp up clean energy investments. He needs to be able to explain to all of those that are responsible in the fossil fuel industry, and especially to the oil and gas industry that is making obscene profits all over the world, that this is the moment to use their profits instead of doubling down on fossil fuels, he said. "We need to triple our present targets to keep below 1.5 degrees warming." Earlier this month, it was reported that more than 60 countries, led by the US, the EU, and UAE, had agreed to push for that larger tripling target to be included in any final declaration made at the end of this COP. The goal is ambitious, but according to a report by the independent public interest think tank, Climate Energy Finance, CEF, the scaling up of the sector is already underway. In 2020, China set a target of deploying 1,200 gigawatts of wind and solar energy by 2030. And in comparison to that, the total capacity of Australia's grid is 71 gigawatts. China's output is now set to reach that target in 2024, 6 years ahead of schedule. Its annual deployment has doubled this year. After leaping by 50% last year, it's installing the equivalent of Australia's East Coast grid in renewables alone every 3 months, showing that the new targets can be achieved. India hasn't signaled its position in the international tripling goal, but its domestic target of installing 450 gigawatts by 2030 is in line with the international target. In the US, the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, which so far has pumped $500 billion in tax breaks and other incentives into green industries, has turbocharged the sector. By one estimate, it could spark $4.5 trillion in climate investment over the coming decade, and that should effectively triple its previous target. So there are other nations that are actually working towards this tripling target. And then there's Australia. Before his departure to COP28, Australia's climate change and energy minister, Chris Bowen, announced an increase in spending on grid-scale renewable energy under a program to be known as the Capacity Investment Scheme. The scheme would funnel billions of taxpayer dollars to underwriting renewable energy projects to raise the share of clean energy generation from about 35% to 82% by the end of the decade. But still, this doesn't leave Australia or the world on track to limit emissions to 1.5 degrees. Clearly, a lot needs to be done, and a very, very large lot needs to be done by Australia. Now, in his opening remarks to COP28 delegates, the UN's Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's Simon Steele, called for unprecedented ambition in a year when so many weather records are already being broken. The urgency to commit to a new energy system is greater than ever, Steele said, because the world can no longer afford to maintain the status quo. If we do not signal the terminal decline of the fossil fuel era as we know it, we welcome our own terminal decline, he said, and we will pay the price with people's lives. You can't be starker than that. So, I've got one final little bit to share with you. It's a word on taxes. For the 2021-2022 financial year, the Australian arm of ExxonMobil had a total income of $15.5 billion. And the Japanese-owned Ichthys had an income of more than $7 billion from selling our gas to the world. Neither of those companies paid any company tax in Australia. Santos claims just $74 million in profit on $4.7 billion in revenue. It also paid zero tax. Australia Pacific LNG, Shell, Yancoal, Glencore, that's a Swiss-based mining company, and Chevron, together they made around $35 billion in total income and $7.5 billion in taxable income from selling our coal and gas. They all paid zero tax. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund has found that Australia subsidises fossil fuels by around $65 billion a year. That's almost $10 billion in explicit subsidies and another $55.6 billion in dealing with fossil fuel pollution causing premature deaths and poor health, as well as environmental damage and global warming. It looks like the rest of us, including other miners, we all pay the nurses that help the people that are hurt by the fossil fuel industry. And on that deep and thoughtful image, that's my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
We've got King Charles very strongly, very starkly warning us and giving suggestions, advice to all the members at COP and the Pope as well.
And the bloke who's in charge of the world.
Yes.
Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General. He's the top diplomat in the world. You can't go much closer. Well, I guess we've also got the statement from the Pope, who wasn't able to make it.
I am going to read an extract of the address that Pope Francis was to deliver here, which will then be published in full. The destruction of the environment is an offense against God, a sin that is not only personal but also structural, one that greatly endangers all human beings, especially the most vulnerable in our midst, and threatens to unleash a conflict between generations. Climate change signals the need for a political change. Let us emerge from the narrowness of self-interest and nationalism. These are approaches belonging to the past. Let us join in embracing an alternative vision. This will help to bring about an ecological conversion, for there are no lasting changes without cultural changes.
Pope Francis' words, delivered at the start of COP28, and it's looking a little bit like in the past we've accused it of being a cop-out, these COP and these annual COP meetings, but it's looking more and more this year that that's not the case. Now, I guess that's on the back of the horrific extreme climate events that occurred in the Northern Hemisphere over their summer and that await us. The Pope's words lead us to our first guest today, Cullen Joyce. Cullen, in his job, he explores how contemporary education can be transformative and supports a deeper connection and care of country and culture. He supports regenerative practice in different eco-activist practices in Melbourne and is a fellow of Contemplative Study Centre at Melbourne Uni. Now, Cullen, first thing, what does a fellow do? I've always wondered that, and I've never, what does a fellow at a university do?
Well, thanks, Tony.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Thank you. I'm proud to be around. So at the Contemplative Study Centre, it's a new centre that was started about 3 years ago through philanthropic funds. And what we do there in general is look at how contemplative practices can support various aspects of health and well-being, including, you know, education and maybe even ecology. And we also look at some of the risks related to that. And my role as a fellow is a bit of a, I do a lot of different things. So I support the educational space, I support the research space, and I support a lot of the public offerings. And my background is kind of, it might be good to talk about that as a translation between some of the kind of community expressions of contemplative practice and well-being with some of the more, I guess, detailed research that is often highly technical. And so a lot of my role really is trying to identify how the research and best practice models that contemplative researchers do can actually be implemented to support various aspects of change and well-being within culture.
Cullen, what's your reaction to the speech from King Charles here? I'm imagining that you must be excited because here's a king speaking to all the leaders of the entire planet, and he's talking about regenerative agriculture and indigenous knowledge, about balance with nature, and all these big aspects of ecology.
Yeah, it's very good to hear. And it's encouraging because not only is the centrality of Indigenous perspectives given, and also the updating of the concern to support human life in its form in some way into the future. But I also take a lot of note personally, his framing of the issue as an intergenerational concern. And a lot of that connects with the work that I do, which is really about trying to build aspects of culture and practice that could support a different form of life than the forms of culture that have, in a sense, caused the climate crisis. And so I really resonated with, the vocation towards ongoing, support for a vibrant ecology and human life. Mm.
And at the same time, we hear Pope Francis talk about that this is not just about science and figures and so on. It's about culture.
Yeah, there's a very important term that's not always easy to understand. They talk about structural sin. And what that means in a Christian context is that there's this kind of structure of life. It could be economic, it could be social, it could be educational, that is consistently causing harm. And that is, a structural sin. And what the Pope's really trying to say is that the climate crisis and driven by release of carbon and driving climate change is in effect a structural sin that's endangering every form of life that we've got, not just ecological, but every form, including religious and spiritual. And so his statement, I think, in relation to, he had made a previous statement a few years ago, but this one's really updating the church on the urgency of the issue and trying to give a sense of where things are at. I think that he's really trying to identify the urgency, but also the need for churches and I guess religious perspectives to start to take the problem much more seriously, because it places religion or spiritual life as a part of the human being at risk too. It becomes very difficult to believe or in practice if you don't have a stable ecology. And I think that's also been a big motivator for my work, is, well, how do we maintain a form of culture and life that's sustainable, so that we can have, in a sense, still be able to do these things that are human, that we seek meaning, we seek sacredness. How do we have a world in which we're still able to do that without ecological collapse?
A lot of our ministers and leaders in this country are actually Catholic, and they don't seem to be listening one bit to their own Catholic leader. Plibersek, our environment minister, spoke when she was elected about the importance of being Catholic, etc., etc., which is all, honestly, BS. BS when you open up new coal mines in the face of what Pope Francis is telling us.
Absolutely. I think one of the troubles is with, Christianity, Western religion, and I guess in terms of the colonizing perspective, is that the sense of what it means to be sacred, what makes something sacred is not the water that you drink to keep you whole and to keep you alive, but divinity has some kind of, you know, difference that makes things sacred. But I think that Catholics sometimes have a bit of a disjunct between the real sacredness of life versus the sacredness that is coming through religious beliefs. And I think that this disjunct has sometimes made it very, made it possible for people to say, well, it's just another thing over there. Sacredness, the sacredness we have is something that we can do when we set up a church. But really, you know, what I think the Pope would want to say, but what I say is really, you know, that the earth is, so without it, we have no nothing. We have no God. We have no sacredness without it. And I think that the extra step to acknowledge the depth of the issue is somewhat experienced by Catholics as a spiritual step that many can't take. And so it does support the recalcitrants within a lot of the communities to fully engage with the ecological problems, because it is actually placing religion itself at risk too, not just, places every part. So, yes, I agree. It's a bit of a disjunct that we have to do something about.
But wouldn't you agree, Colin, that both of the big speeches, or both of the people that we've quoted today, that's the spokesman for the Pope and King Charles, both made the points very, very plain, but both of them were speaking to two separate audiences, if you like. They were speaking to the poorer nations. I mean, the Prince Charles made a big thing about saying that Pakistan was suffering, and going through the British Commonwealth nations that he's the head of, one by one, and pointing out how they're suffering from climate change. But at the same time, he's talking to the rich people in the British Commonwealth, and they're the ones who have got to make the changes. Because getting changes in Pakistan will make very little difference. They didn't do a lot to cause the problems. So he's got two lots of problems. And if you really boil it all down, there's really only one problem, and that is the fossil fuel industry. We've got to stop them spending their billions and billions of dollars on bribing governments not to take action. That's the real problem. That's the only real problem. So you can talk all you like to the people of the world and the delegates and stuff. The real problem lies in the hands of the fossil fuel industry. Would you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. And like we used to have, there's a lot of people used to talk about well, the cause of the problem is an attitudinal difference, or we're not connected enough to the environment, or the cause of climate change is because we see ourselves in disconnection from the world. No, the cause is the release of carbon. It's like the burning of fossil fuels, and it's actually, I think that that language is becoming more and more stark, and so alternative descriptions or alternative narratives about what the causes are just not holding any water. So like, I absolutely agree, and I think that in to some extent, you know, it does make our work a little bit ambiguous because we, you know, we're kind of working around that intensity and that starkness, and we're trying to find, you know, but we do hope that the message will come through, and it's a bit disheartening sometimes, but you know, I think it's a good point to make, Colin.
Colin, speaking about culture, I have a proposal. Why don't we begin to talk about, you know, the phenomena that are related to this burning of fossil fuels in a different way? I mean, why are we talking about, and we see this all the time in the media, for instance, we talk about natural disasters. Why are we not talking about that that's a fossil disaster? When we talk about extreme weather events, we could call them extreme fossil weather events. When we talk about gas, it's not natural gas. Sorry, it's fossil gas. The word fossil, simply by integrating that into our vocabulary, you know, in our language, that's a powerful way to remind ourselves all the time what's causing this. Because I'm sick and tired of reading all these reports again and again and again. And also on TV, we hear every day in the news a new catastrophe here and there and everywhere. But it's never connected to the fact that it's the burning of fossil fuels that's causing this, or at least that's two-thirds of the problem.
Absolutely. The effects on culture are profound because it's the burning of fossil fuels that is placing all these aspects of human life at risk and stating it in those terms, and to some extent allocating blame is a valid way of doing it. And because it's increasingly getting harder and harder to justify when we understand the causal links, it's increasingly harder to make that, to argue that there is not some kind of almost criminal element occurring here. And unfortunately, because of the range of effects, not just environmental but cultural too, that as the climate crisis proceeds, the fossil fuel does, for instance, prevent people from having leisure. So it prevents people from making art. It prevents people from doing philosophy. It prevents people from undertaking specialist research. And it prevents many of the things that, you know, like I used to think about the Large Hadron Collider. Well, without leisure, without these types of things, we don't get the opportunity to make good technology and make discoveries. And so I do feel like sharpening the language is quite appropriate in that respect, but also respectful for what it means to be human and how the actions are taking that are placing many aspects of being human that we feel are intrinsically good at risk.
Welcome to a valley of plenty, a land abundant in nature's resources, but also inspiration. For ours is a community unlike any other. Innovators, thought leaders, and pioneers, creating a fully circular system that is constantly looking for new ways to repair, reuse, restore, recycle, and regenerate so that our products and our planet can live for as long as possible. Where waste can become fertilizer, food, new materials, and energy. And sure, we've found a way of doing things to reduce our impact, but we still have a lot to show. This is Australia's National Centre for Circular Discovery. A way to inspire and educate the next generation. Because we don't just believe circularity can make the world better, we can prove it. And it's up to us to pass it on. So, when you're ready to see, touch, and feel real progress, you can. Because now circularity has a home.
You mentioned at the start that you are work in the contemplative studies area. What exactly do you mean by that?
So contemplative studies is a kind of a contemporary form of research into a very ancient history of contemplative practice that and practices and traditions that humans have done since, you know, virtually all of recorded history. So humans, we undertake, you know, we practice meditation, we chant together, we dance, we do various practices that are broadly bring us to some kind of meditative state or meditative experience of the world. And contemplative studies is really a form of research that is examining what's happening in within those kinds of spaces. Sometimes they're religious, sometimes they're not religious, sometimes they're Indigenous or, you know, Aboriginal First Nations, sometimes they're kind of contemporary. And so we're really concerned with researching what happens within these experiences, but also trying to find ways within a contemporary space of evidence-based research or a different form of evidence than what was previously described as evidence. We're really concerned with how aspects of contemplative practice can support various positive aspects within human life. Can they deepen education? Can they deepen, create better health, mental or physical health? Can they ensure that structures and organizations can be more resilient and actually more creative and less harmful, more empathetic and compassionate to one another? And so I feel within contemplative research, we're really looking at how the mechanisms of meditation can support various positive aspects of human life and experience.
And you've taken that work to eco-activist groups. Why have you gone down that pathway?
Well, I think for me personally, really seeing how the climate crisis places many things that that I take for granted in my life, the access to contemplative practices, a life that can be filled with meaning. So climate crisis makes many of those things very untenable. And so when I got involved with Extinction Rebellion, it was really to say, okay, if I don't try to bring my work into conversation with activism and the climate crisis to try to, you know, stop this type of, the climate crisis from proceeding, then many of the things that I take for granted won't be possible for the next generations. And so my work with the activism, mostly in Melbourne and around different places, was really to try to find ways to that my research and practice in contemplative and meditative spaces can support, I guess, the practice of activism, but also be part of a call for a regenerative culture. So can meditation, can contemplative practices help to support a way of living within our society that is less harmful, less violent, less extractive? And my feeling has always been that meditation and I guess the ability to take a pause and to look in a very open-minded way at your own experience and come to a decision about what is good and act on it has always been central to me making good decisions about how I relate to my environment. And so I always had the sense that meditation can be part of building a less harmful, less extractive culture as we go forward. And just in the work within Extinction Rebellion too, a lot of the activists they tend to be very vulnerable. You know, they're putting themselves out there a lot. They're taking direct action. As you know, Tony, it's highly stressful. My experience is that meditation, although it can't support every aspect of direct action and activism, it can provide something of a continuity that can support people who are doing a lot of the work as well. That's my own personal commitment. There's something I maintain with a lot of the groups around in NAR.
How long do you meditate per day, Colin?
Well, I try to do about 20 to 30 minutes kind of more formally, but I spend a lot of time outside. You know, whenever I've had the chance, I've just tried to walk, try to spend time in nature, and that's been what's doing it for me. And so a lot of the work with Extinction Rebellion and other activist groups has brought me much more into dialogue with Aboriginal perspectives, and that's really had a very dramatically changed how I see contemplative practice as being something which is connecting me with the natural world and about the things which enable me to live. I think, yeah, the formal practice has always been helpful for me and to support the work. But mind you, I think that it's just one of those things. It's very, no matter how well you meditate, when it does come to direct action, it's a stressful environment. And I think that as people have, you know, bring up the courage to do that kind of work, and it's something that I've struggled with too, because it's sometimes hard to stay in the space. But I do feel like the consistent engagement with meditation has at least enabled me to have continual involvement with the movements in ways that are supporting community, even if it's not always doing the direct work.
In our Eastern Gardens, we have a thing that's called the Sri Chimnoy Mile, which was laid out in the 1980s. And Sri Chimnoy was an Indian guru at the time who was influential with Charles's first wife, Princess Diana. And the whole concept of the thing is that you had a track which is exactly a mile long. And he wanted everybody to walk for a mile each day, thinking peaceful thoughts. Clearly it didn't catch on, but we've still got the remnants of it here. And of course, if you could find a way of getting through to a very influential person, even Princess Diana wasn't influential enough to get people walking for a mile thinking peace. But somebody should be doing it, because let's face it, if we were to become a more contemplative society, it would be much easier to get the messages across that we're buggering up our planet and we should be doing something about it while doing peaceful things. Let's face it, war puts vast amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere, and it doesn't just kill people directly, it's killing people in the future too.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think so much of our the way that Western extractive capitalism has been engaging with the world, and itself really has helped us to feel that violence is a default way that we inhabit our this place, you know, the planet. So any kind of call to peace, any kind of call to calmness, does strike against that kind of almost implicit sense of violence that underlies some of the more destructive aspects of culture. But yeah, it's also good to note, of course, that that the cause, in a sense, the cause of the climate crisis is not whether or not we have peaceful hearts, but it's definitely about the fossil fuel still. But yes, I take your point.
I was listening to ABC Radio one day last week, morning radio, and they have a section where they tell you where the cheapest petrol is. You know, they'll say it's $1.20 and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. They go around the different suburbs of Melbourne. And I was thinking myself at the time, I would prefer the bulletin to be along the lines of, when you fill up with petrol, when you fill your car with petrol, you're actually helping Vladimir Putin. You're giving money to Vladimir Putin and Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and all the rogue nations. They're making money out of you putting petrol in your car. And if you can find a way to not put as much petrol in your car, you are not only walking more or cycling more or taking public transport more, then you are not only helping to save the environment, but you're also stopping the rogue nations, stopping pouring money into their pockets. Now, that would be, to me, a much more sensible use of the public airways than telling you where you can get cheap petrol.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I must admit that in recent times, I've come to also acknowledge the role that America's continual war for the last almost 100 years has probably also played in the whole process. And yes, I take your point. Like, there's that, I guess, and Mick was talking about this before, is that, well, how do we shorten the distance between the cause and the language? And so, this weather event is a fossil fuel driven weather event. And I think the more times we can draw that connection closer and closer, and the more powerful the language there, the better. So I think that, any time we can do that is really beneficial.
Colin, I found it interesting. You talk about exploring, in a way, what it means to be human. And that's what I heard King Charles talk about just as well. this exploration of that we need to go somewhere new, somewhere unexplored, somewhere we have not been before, exploring the deeper sense of what it means to be human. And I find it interesting in the UN, in the United Nations context, that, you know, the United Nations have talked for a long time about the development goals and how we can improve the world and these things. And now there's a new thing called the inner development goals, which is actually being taken seriously at the UN level. That's an interesting development.
Absolutely. And I think in the inner development goals, they talk about soft skills as, and to some extent, the context is a little bit like, if we're empathetic, we can also do better as a company. But really what I think is coming through, and definitely the communities that are engaging with the internal development goals, is that we need a more compassionate society. We need a society that can spend time with one another and not be so, I guess, destructive and extractive of one another. And I think that we all want to live in a kind of society where we recognize each other's vulnerability as not just as something to be taken from, but also something to be nurtured and loved and respected. And so when we've, I guess, talked with Aboriginal perspectives too, it's like the oldest continuously living culture, is that we have models for how you can live within a space of mutual respect for land and country and kin. And it doesn't need to come up with these extraordinarily destructive ways of relating to one another and to country. And so, yes, I think that we do need something new, because it's every time we need to ask this question, it requires a new space. But I think also we need to acknowledge that there, what it means to be human has probably been pretty consistent for a long time. And a lot of what we need to be a human being is opportunities and spaces to spend time with one another, opportunities to make bad art or bad music or good art or good music or whatever. And just to take the time that we've got in this extraordinary consciousness, the fact that we're able to see the world and experience it in the way that we do. And actually, that's pretty incredible. Like, apart from the fact that, you know, maybe we can get hamburgers or whatever, but like, just being alive and being human is pretty extraordinary. And I think that the trouble for me, especially within the climate crisis, is that human beings, what we need to live, we don't need very much, really. We don't need as much as we have. But also, like, if we have opportunity just to sit down, we've kind of convinced ourselves sometimes that human beings want to hurt one another or take from each other, but I don't think we do. I think we're actually pretty good things. And I feel like, so what is coming up in the emergent aspect of culture is people saying, look, I don't like that violence. I don't like that that aggression that you're showing towards each other and to the earth. I actually think we should just be nicer. We should be more empathetic and compassionate. And I feel like the vision, that's why contemplative practices is such an important thing, is that we also need space to do that. But I feel that the what are the emergent crises in terms of our economics and our markets are showing, well, people are saying, well, actually, I didn't want that anyway. I would rather just be able to be human. And being human, in a sense, is enough for me. But yeah, we need to slow down. We need to come back to that. And so I do feel like it's going to be new, but it could, what this new expression might be, this new regenerative expression, could be quite unique.
One thing that really stood out to me in, like, it with King Charles's speech was one particular sentence, which is a plea to humanity. And he said, "How dangerous are we prepared to make the earth?"
As we work towards a zero carbon future, we must work equally towards being nature positive. What we are witnessing, our choice now is a starker and darker one. How dangerous are we actually prepared to make our world?
I think that says a lot, so much. It's such a deep comment, and it's such a basic, simple comment as well. But really, the choice that's involved, and, you know, do we realize that we are arrived at this place in time by conscious choices. The corollary of that is that by conscious choices, we can create something better.
That's a good point.
We can go through word by word the speech of the king, and you know, read the lines and try to really understand what it is he's saying. For instance, just after he asked that question about how dangerous we are prepared to make our world, he said, "Change will come by working together. Change will come by working together, and that we have to make it easier to embrace decisions that will sustain our world."
Dealing with this is a job for us all. Change will come by working together and making it easier to embrace decisions that will sustain our world.
What does that mean? Making it easier to embrace decisions that will sustain our world. There's something there to reflect on in many of the things that he said. Time is up for this hour.
Just one postscript. Yesterday, the Extinction Rebellion, December Rebellion, started in Melbourne. Over the next 3 or 4 days, there's going to be a number of activities in Melbourne, some of which are going to be disruptive, some of which are going to be educative. But yeah, it's a, I guess, a summation of a number of, an increasing number of ordinary everyday Australians that have said enough. We are saying the world is too dangerous already, and we're taking action to draw attention to that.
This is Cole. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
Colin, that was amazing to have this sort of reflection on where we need to go, and that there's work to do finding our humanity. There's a whole new direction in what you're talking about there that I think is exciting. It also, in a way, leads, you know, it's coming to New Year, and it leads into 2024 with a different energy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And like my whole work and really my life has been trying to find ways to make sure that this type of experience of humanity where we can able to connect with sacredness and meaning is going to be available for the next 10, 20, 30 generations. And so I think we just got to keep going and just trust that humanity wants to, you know, this good part of us is going to come back out of this climate crisis despite all the tensions that are caused by these bad faith actors.
Exactly. We can be the difference by being human.
Yep.
But let's round off with giving the word once again to the grand old man, King Charles.
We need to remember too that the Indigenous worldview teaches us that we are all connected, not only as human beings, but with all living things and all that sustains life. As part of this grand and sacred system, harmony with nature must be maintained. The earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth.
Little blue, be my shelter, be my cradle, be my womb, be my boat, be my river, be the stillness of. If I could, I'd go with you to a place I never knew. In your eyes, so dark and open, there's a light that leads me back to you. 'Cause you're not so far away, I hear you say, you'll never walk alone, singing, don't be afraid of the dark, in your heart. You're gonna find a way to carry the weight.